Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. On today's episode, I'm joined by investigative journalist, best-selling author, and Pulitzer Prize finalist Garrett Graff. His latest book, UFO, The Inside Story of the U.S. Government's Search for Alien Life Here and Out There, draws from original archival research, declassified documents, and interviews with senior intelligence and military officials to explore America's obsession with UFOs and the government's decades-long pursuit of answers to the age-old question, are we alone in the universe? If you enjoy the show, please leave a 5-star rating and review on your podcast streaming app of choice. And if you're not already, please consider supporting us on Patreon. It's super easy. Just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies. Your generosity helps keep this podcast going. With that out of the way, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Garrett Graff, welcome to Secrets and Spies. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. This will be fun.
So before we get started, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself and your previous work?
Sure, which is actually quite relevant to talking about this subject, which is I am a national security writer and historian. I've spent the last 20 years or so as a magazine editor and writer in Washington. I've written a half dozen histories, all of them national security focused or American politics focused on the Cold War and nuclear weapons and the war on terror and cybersecurity. My book before this most recent one on UFOs was A History of Watergate that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History last year. So I am someone who mostly writes about federal law enforcement and intelligence community and American sort of national security history, which is really how I got interested in the subject in the first place, was not as a lifelong ufologist or someone who was raised on the X-Files and sci-fi novels, but as someone who noticed a marked shift in the way that serious people in Washington were talking seriously about UFOs and UAPs in the last 5 to 7 years.
So your latest book, as you sort of hinted at, is called UFO, The Inside Story of the U.S. Government's Search for Alien Life Here and Out There. A little over a month ago, I had aerospace historian Peter Merlin on to talk about his like massive history of Area 51. And I started that show with a bit of a disclaimer, because like as soon as you drop that word, that name, there's like a ooh kind of effect. So yeah, I started that show with a bit of a disclaimer about what the book is and what it isn't. And I think that's kind of appropriate here as well. So could you tell us like what the book is and what it isn't?
Yeah. So this is, the subtitle of this book is The Inside Story of the U.S. Government's Search for Alien Life Here and Out There. And I tried to weave together two threads that are normally treated pretty separately by journalists and historians, which is the U.S. military's hunt for UFOs here on Earth and the evolving science and astronomy around what people call the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, out across the rest of the universe. And normally those are treated as like two very different subjects. You have the wacky UFO crazy lunatic people here, and then the serious scientists doing serious science work out in the solar system, in the galaxy. And they're not different subjects. You know, they are very closely related insofar as, you know, our understanding of the universe and the evolving science actually has a lot to contribute to our evolving understanding of what the government used to call UFOs and now calls UAPs, unidentified anomalous phenomenon here on Earth, actually are going to turn out to be. And then you have the super basic question as well of, you know, whether or not aliens are visiting Earth has a lot to do with the very basic question of, do aliens exist at all? And those are actually very closely intertwined subjects in a way that I think journalists and historians have done a disservice by trying to draw bright lines in the historiography between those two. So this book goes back across the last 80 years to the dawn of the modern flying saucer age, which is the summer of 1947, which we can talk about sort of why that's the moment that all of this begins, and then comes up to present day and the evolving science and the evolving military process and U.S. government involvement in the search for UFOs across those eight decades.
You sort of hinted on this a bit. There's, I think, layers to one's belief in extraterrestrial life, right? And early on in your book, there's a pretty good description of just the unfathomable vastness of the universe and even our relatively small corner of it. Looking at that, I guess, given the size of that canvas, right? What is just the sheer mathematical probability that aliens exist somewhere, period, full stop?
Yeah, this is actually, to me, one of the biggest revolutions in human knowledge and understanding that we have had in the last quarter century, which is, as late as the 1990s, we did not understand that there was a single planet outside of our own solar system. And we now understand that effectively every star in the universe has planets, and a large number, not necessarily even a large percentage, but a large total number of those planets are going to be habitable by something that we would recognize as life. They are planets that fall into what scientists call the Goldilocks zone. This is something that is, you know, not too hot, not too cold, capable of supporting water, capable of supporting an atmosphere of oxygen. And that number is in the neighborhood of one sextillion across the universe. So that's a billion trillion habitable planets across the universe. So you can believe that the odds of life are long. You can believe that the odds of intelligent life are vanishingly small. But I think it's really hard to argue that we and life as we know it on Earth and humans as intelligent life as we know it is a one in sextillion chance across the universe. From there, though, you get into, you know, some equally interesting and challenging questions about the vast distances of space, but then also just how young our own civilization actually is, which is, as we have come to understand the universe and its, you know, sheer scale and scope and size, we are a very young civilization on a young planet in a young solar system in a very old universe. So we are you can measure human civilization in the tens of thousands of years. Earth itself is, Earth in our solar system is on the, range of 4.5 billion years old. and our universe is about 14 billion. And so you're left with the possibility that life could be common, life could be, intelligent life could be very common, and we could still be functionally alone at this particular moment. That the, you know, it is possible that we have missed the other civilizations and intelligent life that would be in our own galactic neighborhood by billions of years. You know, that you could actually, you know, one of the things that the James Webb Space Telescope is doing right now as it rewrites our understanding of space and time is it has shown that it has captured galaxies and stars that formed as little as 300 million years after the beginning of the universe, after the beginning of time. So you're, one of the strange thought experiments that you're left with as you get into the probabilities and possibilities of SETI is that there could have been multi-billion year civilizations, you know, things more advanced and more amazing and more awe-inspiring than anything that we could possibly fathom, that we have just missed, that have come and gone not just once, but twice or three times over the course of those 14 billion years, even before our solar system even began to gather out of dust.
So something that really strikes me about this topic is how much humility even is required to sort of look at it. Like you said, it's basically a mathematical certainty that aliens will say they exist somewhere, and it's possible that it might even be quite common, you know, alien life. But the chances that they're here or that we'll ever see them are remotely small. And even then, like, if you conceive of a species that could cross interdimensional, interstellar distances of space and time, what that would be to us would be sort of, it would be as perceptible to us as like Shakespeare would be to a golden retriever.
Yeah, and even just what you're talking about, there are a bunch of things to sort of untangle and unpack from that. So let's stick in our dimension as a starting point, which is the founders of SETI had something, Frank Drake was one of the founders, and he came up with something that was called the Drake equation, which is this mathematical equation for how common it would be to find intelligent life across the universe. And, you know, it's a very predictable series of mathematical variables. You know, it's how many planets are there, on what percentage of planets are habitable, what percentage of habitable planets develop life, what percentage of planets that are habitable that develop life develop intelligent life. But the only variable that ends up really mattering is something called L, which is the variable that stands for the length of time that an intelligent civilization lasts. And the whole ball game is what number L is. And if L is in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, intelligent life could be incredibly common across the universe, but basically every civilization would be alone at the moment that it exists. That you would be sort of functionally alone at that moment of time, because any other civilization that existed at that moment would be so far away you would never know, and you wouldn't last long enough to end up having contact with those civilizations, however far away they were. If L is in the millions or hundreds of millions or billions of years, you know, our universe probably teems with life and intelligent life. And one of the weird things as you begin to understand this world is, exactly as you are saying, it's also possible that our universe teems with life and we don't recognize it. Because Hollywood has given us what are effectively sort of three broad scenarios of that first contact problem, you know, sort of the first moment that we discover a alien civilization. And they are all unambiguous and clear. You know, you have the Independence Day flying saucer over the White House. Take me to your leader. I'm here for friendship or to invade you and harvest you your organs for food or energy. You have the Jodie Foster contact radio message from outer space. And then you have the E.T. stranded traveler situation. Probably all three of those are totally wrong about what our first contact would actually be, because they are all human-centric in a way that presuppose anyone would be interested in our existence and would bother discovering us and coming here. Whereas there is plenty of evidence, as you say, that any civilization that has mastered interstellar space travel would, you know, be exploring outer space and might stumble upon Earth, but is unlikely to have noticed our existence given how new we are. And that aliens, if they happen to be visiting Earth, are more likely to be treating it like we would treat a rest area on the Jersey Turnpike, as in as a place to stop over on the way from one interesting place to another. Carl Sagan, when you know, the famous astronomer of the 20th century, he was simultaneously the biggest skeptic that UFOs represented aliens visiting Earth, while also being the primary driver and enthusiast for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence across the rest of the universe. And his argument was never that aliens don't visit Earth. His argument was, statistically, based on the Drake equation, based on what we know about the vastness of space, you would only expect an alien civilization to pass by Earth every 100,000 or 200,000 years. And so it's not that aliens don't visit Earth. It's that that weird thing that you saw out your window last Tuesday afternoon is unlikely statistically to be the one time in these 200,000 years that an alien happened to pop by. Now, now one of the parts of that is, again, any civilization that has mastered interstellar space travel is probably traveling at a fraction of the speed of light. Not necessarily a large fraction, but a meaningful fraction of the speed of light. We don't have a single piece of technology on Earth in human existence right now that would notice or be able to detect and identify something moving through our solar system at a fraction of the speed of light. So one of the weirder thought experiments of this is that our solar system could be getting crossed by alien spacecraft almost every day, maybe a couple of times a year, maybe a couple of times a decade, you know, maybe once or twice a century. And we wouldn't have any idea about it, and we wouldn't be able to see it. And that, in fact, when and if we ever actually do detect something coming through our solar system, our first contact is probably going to be something much more mysterious and much more ambiguous that is not human-centric and not Earth-centric, which is to say, we are likely to see a old space probe or a piece of a wreckage of spacecraft or sort of something floating through our solar system, the sort of rough equivalent of an empty plastic bag blowing through our cosmic backyard, where we look up one day and catch something, you know, photographically at least, that, and say, you know, well, that empty plastic bag isn't from our Walmart. Like, whose Walmart did that come from? And we're going to, you know that there's an intelligent civilization out there, but not necessarily be able to know, like, does it still exist? Is it close by? Is it friend or foe? You know, sort of any of the details that you would sort of want to know about a, you know, potential other civilization. And then in your question there, you also hinted to me at one of the like other weird bits of this whole saga, which is there's a lot of interesting stuff we don't know yet about the universe that we should be very humble about, and that the answer is probably going to be that the world and the universe is a much weirder place than we give it credit for. And so when you get into what are UFOs, what are UAPs, the answer, I think, some chunk of the answer is going to end up being physics that we don't yet understand, and that we sort of like to think that we understand the world. We like to think that we understand physics. But Harvard Astronomy Chair Avi Loeb points out, you know, last January, the world's oldest woman died. She was a French nun. She was 118 years old. And in her lifetime, humans learned everything that we know about relativity and quantum physics. So imagine what we could learn or will learn about physics in the next 100, in the next 500, the next 1,000, the next 2,000 or 10,000 years. And that the answers there could be incredibly weird stuff. You know, it could be, as you sort of hand-waved at, interdimensional travel. It could be parallel universes. It could be time travel from the past or future. I mean, things that would be, to us, as weird and as interesting as the answer being extraterrestrials visiting Earth, but mm-hmm. still not be aliens. And I think that the thing that people get stuck on in the world of ufology that I really tried to navigate around and through in this book is most people come at this subject either as sort of true believers, like UFOs equal aliens, or total skeptics. And that the truth to me most likely involves holding a lot of contradictory views at once, which is aliens almost certainly exist. They're probably too far away for us to know. UFOs probably are not aliens, but the answer to what UFOs could be is almost certainly things that will blow our mind that we don't yet understand.
One of my takeaways from this book, I think there's been a thought in my generation, you know, that one of the big things that could happen in our lifetime is that, you know, we'll actually like encounter one of these races. I don't think that's very likely at all based on the reasons that you just said. I also sort of, what I took away from this book was that in the infinitesimally small chance that that happens, I don't think anyone who's alive on this planet right now wants to be. Like, I think of, like, you know, what happened to, like, indigenous groups in the Americas when the Europeans showed up. Why would that be any different for us?
Yeah, so I think you're right. I think the challenge is we're almost, even if we get some sort of contact with aliens or with another intelligent civilization, or what sort of people like to now call NHIs, non-human intelligences, it might be, you know, it might be sort of so mysterious and ambiguous that it's not quite the revolution in human knowledge and experience that we think it is. I think we have this idea in our society that, like, you know, the aliens are going to land on the White House lawn and it's going to change everything. And, you know, then they'll either come and invade us or, you know, we'll enter into, you know, some sort of long-term economic trading status with them where, like, we're giving them iPads and, you know, they're giving us ray guns and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think the most likely scenario is we're going to end up seeing, as I said, some piece of space trash that we're going to, and I think that the chances of that in our lifetime or human existence, broadly speaking, seem very high to me. You know, I don't know what the exact probability or chances are, but, like, there's a lot of stuff out there that we are only beginning to realize that we should be looking for. That, again, you know, you go back a decade and we had never seen a interstellar object. You know, we had never detected something coming from outside of our solar system and passing through our solar system. And, you know, in the last 50 years, like, we've sent 4 interstellar objects out into space as humans. And in the last decade, we've started to detect actually a lot of interstellar objects crossing through our solar system, beginning in 2017 with an object called Oumuamua, which was at that moment the first ever detected interstellar object. In the time since, we have seen, you know, like, maybe not quite once a year, but we've begun to realize that they are more common than we thought. So I think as technology advances, as we better understand what to be looking for, you know, we might be, again, find that there's all sorts of evidence of alien civilizations crossing our solar system. It's just not stuff coming and visiting Earth per se, because they're aliens interested in visiting humans. And so one of my questions that I was left with in this project was, what if we sort of discover aliens exist, but then, like, it doesn't actually change that much for humans on Earth? That, like,
yeah,
it, like, there's sort of a different version of this where, you know, scientists, you know, detect next year that there, you know, there's an empty spacecraft floating through our solar system. And, you know, we get some, like, grainy pictures of it, and we can sort of determine the rough, like, size and shape of it, you know, and we're able to sort of, like, generally narrow down its trajectory to say, like, it came from this corner of outer space. Like, that's a couple of weeks of really fascinating headlines and, you know, amazing panels at the Aspen Ideas Forum and, you know, at the Munich Security Conference and things like that. And that's sort of like, everyone's just going to go back to their daily life and they're going to be like, there's a bunch of stuff here on Earth that we need to sort out. Now, to me, the, like, hope and optimism of SETI is, like, just imagine all of the stuff we still have to learn about our universe. Like, imagine all of the crazy things that we can learn if we get another 10,000 years of human history to explore. And so to me, I think that there is, to me, there's, like, this thing that, like, you look around the planet right now and, like, there's a lot of reasons to believe that, like, humans don't get another 1,000 years, that we, you know, that maybe we don't get another 100 years. Like, there's a lot of reasons, a lot of days to feel like we don't get another 10 or 20 years. And, like, to me, like, I look at these questions of interstellar exploration and advancing science and advancing physics, and I'm like, man, like, we should get our act together here on Earth and, like, take care of what we have, because, like, we are protecting all of the future generations of human knowledge and human exploration. And there's a great book about this, if your listeners are interested, after reading my book, which is Toby Ord's book, The Precipice, which dives into some of these questions about, like, what the rest of human civilization could be like.
Your book opens at the beginning of the modern fascination with and possible encounters with UFOs, right after World War II. Could you sort of briefly describe that moment for us?
Yeah. So the modern flying saucer era begins in the summer of 1947, and it begins in the shadow of the Cold War. June 1947, there's a Idaho businessman named Kenneth Arnold who is flying his plane across the Pacific Northwest near the Cascades, and he spots 9 saucer-shaped objects moving at what he says are tremendous speed. He lands, tells some friends about this, they tell the media picks this up, and it becomes really the moment that flying saucers emerge in American popular culture and popular media. And that summer kicks off sightings all across the country of these flying saucers, across 34 states, up into Canada, almost every single day that summer, people in the United States are spotting these flying saucers. They're running stories on the front page of the newspapers day after day after day. There are grainy photographs of flying saucers getting published in newspapers along the way. The Roswell crash happens that summer as part of all of this and is sort of quickly forgotten at that moment against the broader backdrop of this summer of flying saucers. And the government really goes into a panic. And it goes into a panic not because anyone thinks that these are aliens, because in that first summer, no one really is saying that these are aliens. What the government is concerned about is that these are secret Soviet spacecraft being built by kidnapped Nazi rocket scientists. Because what is the United States doing in the summer of 47? We are building early secret spacecraft and rockets with, we would use a word different than kidnapped. We would say that we had provided unique and interesting employment opportunities to former Nazi rocket scientists to...
That's Operation Paperclip.
Operation Paperclip. To avoid being tried for war crimes and executed in exchange for coming to Los Alamos and the White Sands Proving Grounds and helping us build the next generation of V-2 rockets. So the government is afraid, again, not that these are aliens, but it's that the Soviet Union has cracked the code of, you know, flying saucer spacecraft ahead of us. And so the government goes into this, you know, early Cold War panic about what flying saucers are, and it kicks off the beginning of what is recognizable still to us today of this self-perpetuating cycle of public sightings fueling national security interest that fuels Hollywood pop culture imagination that then fuels more public sightings, which then fuels new national security panics, on and on up to the present day.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more.
When you think of fascists, Germany's Adolf Hitler and Italy's Benito Mussolini come to mind. But what about those who embraced fascism in the United States?
He was thought by some to be truly mad. He hoped to lead a fascist movement that would ally with Nazi Germany.
He was inarguably the greatest anti-Semitic propagandist in the history of the world.
They would have an insurrection. They would take over the Capitol building. They would take over the White House. They felt that the majority of Americans would follow them.
The day will come no matter who stands in our way.
And this podcast will take a deep dive into characters that both fostered and fought against American autocracy in the past century.
He told me, if this guy says one more thing, I'm going to jump up there and punch him in the face and just take him out.
This is Star Spangled Fascism, hosted by Bradley W. Hart.
Hey, this is Rachel Maddow from MSNBC. Congratulations on Star Spangled Fascism. So looking forward to this podcast. Bradley, this is going to be fantastic.
As you said, the sort of hunt for alien life developed over those following decades in fits and starts through various academic and privately funded projects and endeavors, some of which with government involvement. Your book goes into detail about a lot of these events over the, you know, following years, Roswell, Project Blue Book, all that stuff. Based on your research for the book, if there's like one incident over this time that makes you sit up and think, if any of these are real, it's this one. Is there any story like that?
Yeah. So I think that there's a category of stories that feel interesting to me, which there are over the years, a handful, not hundreds, but scores, maybe dozens, of credible witnesses who have encounters and experiences where there is at least circumstantial evidence that backs up their experience, that come from totally ordinary backgrounds and go on to have totally ordinary lives. And what I mean by that are witnesses who are not previously prone to UFO beliefs, and people who do not go on to say, and from then on, the alien came by every Thursday afternoon and had tea with me, which like is a specific sort of breed and thread of witnesses that you see, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, in a group that's known as the contactees, sort of people who come forward and are like, I was contacted by this alien who told me that humans should live in peaceful coexistence. And he wanted me to spread his message to the people on Earth and avoid nuclear war. And the alien comes back every couple of months and checks on how we're doing. So these credible witnesses to me are people like Lonnie Zamora, which is a case that I talk about in the book from 1964, where he's a local Socorro, New Mexico police officer who is chasing a speeder on the way out of town in the desert when he hears an explosion and looks out into the desert and sees what he thinks is an overturned car. He abandons the pursuit of the speeder and begins driving through the desert towards this overturned vehicle. As he gets closer, he describes it as a football-shaped white object. There are two figures outside of it that get into the craft, and the craft takes off. Now, something happened to Lonnie Zamora in that desert that day in 1964 that there was a New Mexico state trooper who showed up just a couple of minutes later on the scene, who saw him shaken up and traumatized by whatever the thing was that he saw. The FBI responds and interviews him. The military responds and interviews him. They find some circumstantial physical evidence that there was something in the desert at the spot that he identified as the landing zone of this craft. And, you know, then Lonnie Zamora goes on and leads a totally normal life for the rest of his life. Like, he just goes back to being a small town cop, never tries to monetize this, you know, doesn't write a tell-all book, doesn't try to get on the talk shows, you know, doesn't become the 1960s equivalent of a reality TV star, or, you know, open his Cameo account, or, you know, anything like that. And there are other people like him over the years, much more recently and much more sort of relevantly to our current discussion. You know, you've had this series of Navy fighter pilots come forward in the last decade to talk about encounters that they have had that are backed up by video, by radar, by, you know, mechanical evidence and technological evidence that something happened to them.
These are the flying Tic Tacs.
The Tic Tac encounter, the gimbal, the FLIR, you know, people like Ryan Graves and David Fravor. These are credible witnesses, and not people who have a reason to come forward to report a UFO encounter, and in fact have a lot of reasons going against them about why they shouldn't be the people coming forward to talk about their UFO encounter. You know, if you are a Navy fighter pilot or a Navy aviator, like, there are a lot of reasons that you don't want to be the person coming back to the aircraft carrier and being like, oh man, you wouldn't believe the UFO that I had a dogfight with today. Like, that's the type of thing that, like, gets you carried off in a straitjacket and never lets you fly again. And so for these people to come forward to testify about what they've seen, for there to be evidence that backs up their encounter, you know, this really makes me feel like there are witnesses like this that are worth listening to, who point to the idea that, like, UFOs are something, which, again, gets at sort of the contradictory challenge of this, which is like, you can say like something happened to Lonnie Zamora in the desert that day, you know, something happened to Ryan Graves and David Fravor and the, you know, the other Navy fighter pilots. And the answer doesn't have to be that it's UFOs from Alpha Centauri happening to buzz the USS Nimitz. You know, it can be a lot of interesting and weird stuff and still not be aliens.
There's so much about these individual stories and stuff that I would love to unpack with you. And there's so much in the book for listeners to discover, too. One of the really interesting aspects of this book that, with the time that we have left, I definitely want to make sure that we get into, talks about the conspiracy theory culture around UFOs and how, in a way, the current kind of casualness that the country looks at conspiracies and its distrust in government and public institutions. Like a week ago, there was that poll that like 1 in 5 Americans believe that Taylor Swift is part of a psyop to rig the Super Bowl and reelect Joe Biden, because...
Which is true. I was in that meeting with the Illuminati.
You got the memo?
And it was a really fun plan, and like all the props to Dark Brandon for pulling it off.
I just didn't get invited to the Super Bowl watch party at like Raven Rock, yeah. Which I was really mad about that. Anyway, so talk us through a bit about how that kind of conspiracy culture began in the UFO movement, and a character in particular, Bill Cooper.
Yeah. So this to me was one of the most interesting parts of this book project, which, as I said at the start, the book before this that I worked on was A History of Watergate. And in a very weird and unexpected way, the second half of my UFO book is actually really good sequel to a book on Watergate, which is, it is about the rise, the second half of the UFO story in the 20th century is the story of the rise of government conspiracy theories that unfold in the wake of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers and Vietnam and the Church Committee and the Pike Committee. And, you know, the sense, this dawning sense in the 1970s that, you know, the government will lie, that the government carries out, you know, dastardly deeds and assassination plots and kidnapping plots without telling the American people. And you see in those 70s and 80s, the rise of Roswell really as the defining conspiracy theory, you know, the idea that the government has recovered flying saucers, that it's recovered alien bodies. You know, the more extreme versions of this hold that, you know, the government actually is in contact with alien civilizations, that, you know, they've made treaties with alien civilizations, you know, that the U.S. Special Forces have done battle against alien civilizations in, you know, the American Southwest. You know, there are sort of a lot of layers of this. And what you begin to see and understand is that it's really these conspiracies in the 70s and 80s that plant in the American political tradition for the first time what we would now call and recognize as the idea of the deep state, that there is this, you know, professional government secret hidden away that is working at cross purposes and lying to elected officials and the American public. And it is hard to think of something that is a bigger secret that the U.S. government could be keeping than, you know, that it has recovered evidence of aliens, that it's in contact with aliens. The only thing that would come close to equaling that is, like, you know, the idea that, like, Joe Biden is directly talking to God. Like, I mean, you're talking about, like, the biggest possible secrets that a government could keep from the American people and from humans in general. And that this group of conspiracists in the 1980s lays that intellectual foundation for the idea of the deep state. And in many ways, some of those figures from those conspiracies in the 70s and 80s become the founding voices of the far right extreme fringe of the 1990s. And you mentioned, you know, one of the main figures there, Bill Cooper, who is in the 1980s sort of first surfaces as a purported former naval intelligence officer who says that he has seen the paperwork about the government's contact with aliens, who goes on in the 1990s to found and run one of the most popular conservative talk radio shows in the country, and has two fans of note. The first is Tim McVeigh, who goes on, of course, to be the bomber behind the attack on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Deadliest domestic terror attack on U.S. soil. And that a couple of months before the attack, McVeigh and his co-conspirator Terry Nichols actually go out to Bill Cooper's compound in Arizona to talk with him about white supremacy and their sort of far-right extreme fringe views. And then as their parting comment to Bill Cooper, say, "Watch Oklahoma City." And, you know, Bill Cooper has no idea what to make of this and, you know, just goes back to his normal life. And then, of course, the explosion happens and he sort of realizes who the people were that came out to visit him. The other person that Bill Cooper influences in the 1990s is a young Austin, Texas public access host named Alex Jones. And that Alex Jones goes off to, you know, lead his own far right talk radio shows. He and Bill Cooper have a big falling out after 9/11 when Alex Jones embraces what we now call 9/11 trutherism, sort of the 9/11 conspiracy theories. And that, you know, Alex Jones really becomes sort of the second generation of these conspiracists and on up through birtherism and what we, you know, now call the big lie around January 6th. And so to me, one of the like most fascinating and unexpected aspects of diving into the history of ufology in the United States is realizing that you probably don't get January 6th without the intellectual foundation of UFO conspiracies from the 1970s and 1980s. Now, some people, when I say that, hear me say everyone who believes in UFOs is a far-right extremist, but that's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it is the UFO conspiracies that lay the intellectual foundation for the government conspiracies that grow into January 6th.
Sort of a last thought here, because I know we have to wrap up soon. This was a big takeaway for me when I finished the book the other night. There's a screaming irony in the sense that, like, the UFO conspiracy culture that sort of infected in a way the rest of society, right? I'm thinking of like the L in the Drake Equation is perhaps the biggest threat to us right now of surviving long enough to encounter one of these alien races or being capable of interstellar travel ourselves. I don't know if you have a reaction to that.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point, and you're absolutely right that, like, you know, it is the reason that we don't survive as a species will end up being, you know, if it happens, you know, some combination of climate change denialism and, you know, misinformation and the fall of democracy and, you know, in place of authoritarianism, sort of, et cetera, et cetera. And also, you know, part of L is just this question of, like, do humans remain curious about the world beyond them? Because there's sort of a different version of, you know, humanity's future arc that ends up being like, you know, the movie Idiocracy, where, you know,
stagnation,
where we, you know, we all sort of become so fascinated by social media and alternate reality headsets and video games that we just, like, don't bother looking up at the stars anymore. And that to me is actually like a very dark but very foreseeable potential path of the next century.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Let's leave listeners with that cuddly thought for the day. Garrett, where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
So I'm Vermont GMG, Vermont, my initials GMG, on Twitter and Instagram and sort of where Threads, sort of whatever social media platform you use. I'm Vermont GMG, and then GarrettGraff.com, and the book is UFO, the inside story of the U.S. government's search for alien life here and out there, and it's available wherever you like to get your books.
Well, thank you so much for that. We'll have links to all of that in the show notes. Definitely go pick up the book, guys. We're just a fascinating subject that we could talk about for so much longer. Garrett, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.